happened? How did you escape?
Harry explained briefly how the Death Eaters, pursuing them, had seemed to recognize him as the true Harry, how they had abandoned the chase, how they must have summoned Voldemort, who had appeared just before he and Hagrid had reached the sanctuary of Tonks's parents.
They recognized you? But how? What had you done?
Harry tried to remember. The whole journey seemed like a blur of panic and confusion.
I saw Stan Shunpike.
You know, the bloke who was the conductor on the night bus. And I tried to disarm him instead of... Well, he doesn't know what he's doing, does he? He must be imperious.
Lupin looked aghast.
Harry, the time for disarming is past. These people are trying to capture and kill you. At least Stan, if you aren't prepared to kill.
We were hundreds of feet up. Stan's not himself, and if I stunned him and he'd fallen, he'd have died the same as if I'd used Avada Kedavra. Expelliarmus saved me from Voldemort 2 years ago, Harry added defiantly.
Lupin was reminding him of the sneering Hufflepuff Zacharias Smith, who had jeered at Harry for wanting to teach Dumbledore's army how to disarm.
Yes, Harry, said Lupin with painful restraint, and a great number of Death Eaters witnessed that happening. Forgive me, but it was a very unusual move then, under imminent threat of death. Repeating it tonight in front of Death Eaters, who either witnessed or heard about the first occasion, was close to suicidal.
So you think I should have killed Stan Shunpike? Said Harry angrily.
Of course not, said Lupin. But the Death Eaters, frankly, most people, would have expected you to attack back. Expelliarmus is a useful spell, Harry, but the Death Eaters seem to think it is your signature move, and I urge you not to let it become so.
Lupin was making Harry feel idiotic, and yet there was still a grain of defiance inside him.
I won't blast people out of my way just because they're there, said Harry. That's Voldemort's job.
Lupin's retort was lost. Finally succeeding in squeezing through the door, Hagrid staggered to a chair and sat down. It collapsed beneath him. Ignoring his mingled oaths and apologies, Harry addressed Lupin again.
Will George be okay?
All Lupin's frustration with Harry seemed to drain away at the question.
I think so, although there's no chance of replacing his ear, not when it's been cursed off.
There was a scuffling from outside. Lupin dived for the back door. Harry leapt over Hagrid's legs and sprinted into the yard. Two figures had appeared in the yard, and as Harry ran toward them, he realized they were Hermione, now returning to her normal appearance, and Kingsley, both clutching a bent coat hanger. Hermione flung herself into Harry's arms, but Kingsley showed no pleasure at the sight of any of them. Over Hermione's shoulder, Harry saw him raise his wand and point it at Lupin's chest.
The last words Albus Dumbledore spoke to the pair of us.
Harry is the best hope we have. Trust him, said Lupin calmly.
Kingsley turned his wand on Harry, but Lupin said,
It's him. I've checked.
All right, said Kingsley, stowing his wand back beneath his cloak. But somebody betrayed us. They knew it was tonight.
So it seems, replied Lupin. But apparently they did not realize that there would be 7 Harrys.
Small comfort, snarled Kingsley. Who else is back?
Only Harry, Hagrid, George and me.
Hermione stifled a little moan behind her hand.
What happened to you? Lupin asked Kingsley.
Followed by 5 injured, 2 might have killed 1, Kingsley reeled off. And we saw you-know-who as well. He joined the chase halfway through, but vanished pretty quickly. Remus, he can
fly, supplied Harry.
I saw him too. He came after Hagrid and me.
So that's why he left, to follow you, said Kingsley. I couldn't understand why he'd vanished, but what made him change targets?
Harry behaved a little too kindly to Stan Shunpike, said Lupin. Stan? Repeated Hermione. But I thought he was in Azkaban.
Kingsley let out a mirthless laugh.
Hermione, there's obviously been a mass breakout which the Ministry has hushed up. Travers' hood fell off when I cursed him. He's supposed to be inside, too. But what happened to you, Remus? Where's George?
He lost an ear, said Lupin.
Lost an...
repeated Hermione in a high voice.
Snape's work, said Lupin.
Snape! Shouted Harry.
You didn't say...
He lost his hood during the chase. Sectum Sempra was always a speciality of Snape's. I wish I could say I'd paid him back in kind, but it was all I could do to keep George on the broom after he was injured. He was losing so much blood.
Silence fell between the four of them as they looked up at the sky. There was no sign of movement. The stars stared back, unblinking, indifferent, unobscured by flying friends.
Where was Ron? Where were Fred and Mr. Weasley? Where were Bill, Fleur, Tonks, Mad-Eye, and Mundungus?
Harry, give us a hand,
called Hagrid hoarsely from the door, in which he was stuck again. Glad of something to do, Harry pulled him free, then headed through the empty kitchen and back into the sitting room, where Mrs. Weasley and Ginny were still tending to George. Mrs. Weasley had staunched his bleeding now, and by the lamplight, Harry saw a clean, gaping hole where George's ear had been.
How is he?
Mrs. Weasley looked around and said,
I can't make it grow back, not when it's been removed by dark magic, but it could have been so much worse. He's alive.
Yeah, said Harry. Thank God.
Did I hear someone else in the yard?
Ginny asked.
Hermione and Kingsley, said Harry.
Thank goodness, Ginny whispered. They looked at each other. Harry wanted to hug her, hold on to her. He did not even care much that Mrs. Weasley was there. But before he could act on the impulse, there was a great crash from the kitchen.
I'll prove who I am, Kingsley, after I've seen my son. Now, back off if you know what's good for you.
Harry had never heard Mr. Weasley shout like that before. He burst into the living room, his bald patch gleaming with sweat, his spectacles askew, Fred right behind him, both pale but uninjured.
Arthur, sobbed Mrs. Weasley. Oh, thank goodness.
How is he?
Mr. Weasley dropped to his knees beside George. For the first time since Harry had known him, Fred seemed to be lost for words. He gaped over the back of the sofa at his twin's wound as if he could not believe what he was seeing. Perhaps roused by the sound of Fred and their father's arrival, George stirred.
How do you feel, Georgie?
Whispered Mrs. Weasley. George's fingers groped for the side of his head.
Saint-like,
he murmured.
What's wrong with him?
Croaked Fred, looking terrified.
Is his mind affected?
Saint-like,
repeated George, opening his eyes and looking up at his brother.
You see? I'm holy. Hole-y, Fred. Get it?
Mrs. Weasley sobbed harder than ever. Colour flooded Fred's pale face.
Pathetic, he told George. Pathetic! With a whole wide world of ear-related humour before you, you go for holy.
Ah, well,
said George, grinning at his tear-soaked mother.
You'll be able to tell us apart now anyway, Mum.
He looked around.
Hi, Harry. You are Harry, right?
Yeah, I am,
said Harry, moving closer to the sofa.
Well, at least we got you back okay,
said George. Why aren't Ron and Bill huddled around my sick bed?
They're not back yet, George,
said Mrs. Weasley. George's grin faded. Harry glanced at Ginny and motioned to her to accompany him back outside. As they walked through the kitchen, she said in a low voice,
Ron and Tonks should be back by now. They didn't have a long journey. Auntie Muriel's not that far from here.
Harry said nothing. He had been trying to keep fear at bay ever since reaching the burrow, but now it enveloped him, seeming to crawl over his skin, throbbing in his chest, clogging his throat. As they walked down the back steps into the dark yard, Ginny took his hand. Kingsley was striding backward and forward, glancing up at the sky every time he turned. Harry was reminded of Uncle Vernon pacing the living room a million years ago. Hagrid, Hermione, and Lupin stood shoulder to shoulder, gazing upward in silence. None of them looked around when Harry and Ginny joined their silent vigil. The minutes stretched into what might as well have been years. The slightest breath of wind made them all jump and turn toward the whispering bush or tree in the hope that one of the missing order members might leap unscathed from its leaves. And then a broom materialized directly above them and streaked toward the ground.
"It's them!"
screamed Hermione. Tonks landed in a long skid that sent earth and pebbles everywhere.
"Remus!"
Tonks cried as she staggered off the broom into Lupin's arms. His face was set and white. He seemed unable to speak. Ron tripped dazedly toward Harry and Hermione.
"You're okay,"
he mumbled, before Hermione flew at him and hugged him tightly.
I thought...
"I'm all right," said Ron, patting her on the back. "I'm fine."
"Ron was great,"
said Tonks warmly, relinquishing her hold on Lupin.
"Wonderful. Stunned one of the Death Eaters, straight to the head, and when you're aiming at a moving target from a flying broom—"
"You did?"
said Hermione, gazing up at Ron with her arms still around his neck.
"Always the tone of surprise," he said a little grumpily, breaking free. "Are we the last back?"
"No,"
said Ginny. "We're still waiting for Bill and Fleur and Mad-Eye and Mundungus. I'm going to tell Mum and Dad you're okay, Ron."
She ran back inside.
"So what kept you? What happened?"
Lupin sounded almost angry at Tonks.
"Bellatrix," said Tonks. "She wants me quite as much as she wants Harry, Remus. She tried very hard to kill me. I just wish I'd got her. I owe Bellatrix. But we definitely injured Rodolphus. Then we got to Ron's Auntie Muriel's, and we'd missed our portkey, and she was fussing over us."
A muscle was jumping in Lupin's jaw. He nodded, but seemed unable to say anything else.
"So, what happened to you lot?"
Tonks asked, turning to Harry, Hermione, and Kingsley. They recounted the stories of their own journeys, but all the time, the continued absence of Bill, Fleur, Mad-Eye, and Mundungus seemed to lie upon them like a frost, its icy bite harder and harder to ignore.
"I'm going to have to get back to Downing Street. I should have been there an hour ago,"
said Kingsley finally, after a last sweeping gaze at the sky.
"Let me know when they're back."
Lupin nodded. With a wave to the others, Kingsley walked away into the darkness toward the gate. Harry thought he heard the faintest pop as Kingsley disapparated just beyond the burrow's boundaries. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley came racing down the back steps, Ginny behind them. Both parents hugged Ron before turning to Lupin and Tonks.
"Thank you,"
said Mrs. Weasley,
"for our sons." "Don't be silly, Molly,"
said Tonks at once.
"How's George?" asked Lupin.
"What's wrong with him?"
piped up Ron.
"He's lost—"
But the end of Mrs. Weasley's sentence was drowned in a general outcry. A thestral had just soared into sight and landed a few feet from them. Bill and Fleur slid from its back, windswept but unhurt.
"Bill, thank God, thank God!"
Mrs. Weasley ran forward, but the hug Bill bestowed upon her was perfunctory. Looking directly at his father, he said, "Mad-Eye's dead." Nobody spoke. Nobody moved. Harry felt as though something inside him was falling, falling through the earth, leaving him forever.
"We saw it," said Bill.
Fleur nodded, tear tracks glittering on her cheeks in the light from the kitchen window.
"It happened just after we broke out of the circle. Mad-Eye and Dung were close by us. They were heading north, too. Voldemort, he can fly, went straight for them. Dung panicked. I heard him cry out. Mad-Eye tried to stop him, but he disapparated. Voldemort's curse hit Mad-Eye full in the face. He fell backward off his broom, and there was nothing we could do, nothing. We had half a dozen of them on our own tail."
Bill's voice broke.
"Of course you couldn't have done anything," said Lupin.
They all stood looking at each other. Harry could not quite comprehend it. Mad-Eye dead? It could not be. Mad-Eye, so tough, so brave. The consummate survivor. At last it seemed to dawn on everyone, though nobody said it, that there was no point waiting in the yard any more. And in silence, they followed Mr. and Mrs. Weasley back into the burrow and into the living room, where Fred and George were laughing together.
"What's wrong?"
said Fred, scanning their faces as they entered.
What's happened? Who's...
Mad-Eye, said Mr. Weasley. Dead. The twins' grins turned to grimaces of shock. Nobody seemed to know what to do. Tonks was crying silently into a handkerchief. She had been close to Mad-Eye, Harry knew, his favorite and his protege at the Ministry of Magic. Hagrid, who had sat down on the floor in the corner where he had most space, was dabbing at his eyes with his tablecloth-sized handkerchief. Bill walked over to the sideboard and pulled out a bottle of fire whiskey and some glasses. "Here," he said, and with a wave of his wand, he sent 12 full glasses soaring through the room to each of them, holding the 13th aloft. "Mad-Eye!"
"Mad-Eye,"
they all said, and drank.
"Mad-Eye,"
echoed Hagrid, a little late, with a hiccup. The fire whiskey seared Harry's throat. It seemed to burn feeling back into him, dispelling the numbness and sense of unreality, firing him with something that was like courage.
"So Mundungus disappeared," said Lupin, who had drained his own glass in one.
The atmosphere changed at once. Everybody looked tense, watching Lupin, both wanting him to go on, it seemed to Harry, and slightly afraid of what they might hear.
"I know what you're thinking," said Bill, "and I wondered that too, on the way back here, because they seemed to be expecting us, didn't they? But Mundungus can't have betrayed us. They didn't know there would be 7 Harrys. That confused them the moment we appeared. And, in case you've forgotten, it was Mundungus who suggested that little bit of skullduggery. Why wouldn't he have told them the essential point? I think Dung panicked. It's as simple as that. He didn't want to come in the first place. But Mad-Eye made him, and you-know-who went straight for them. It was enough to make anyone panic."
"You-know-who acted exactly as Mad-Eye expected him to," sniffed Tonks. "Mad-Eye said he'd expect the real Harry to be with the toughest, most skilled Aurors. He chased Mad-Eye first, and when Mundungus gave them away, he switched to Kingsley."
"Yes, and that is all very good," snapped Fleur. "But still it does not explain how they knew we were moving Harry tonight, does it? Somebody must have been careless. Somebody let slip the date to an outsider. It is the only explanation for them knowing the date but not the whole plan."
She glared around at them all, tear tracks still etched on her beautiful face, silently daring any of them to contradict her. Nobody did. The only sound to break the silence was that of Hagrid hiccuping from behind his handkerchief. Harry glanced at Hagrid, who had just risked his own life to save Harry's. Hagrid, whom he loved, whom he trusted, who had once been tricked into giving Voldemort crucial information in exchange for a dragon's egg.
"No,"
Harry said aloud, and they all looked at him surprised. The fire whiskey seemed to have amplified his voice.
"I mean, if somebody made a mistake," Harry went on, "and let something slip, I know they didn't mean to do it. It's not their fault,"
he repeated, again a little louder than he would usually have spoken.
"We've got to trust each other. I trust all of you. I don't think anyone in this room would ever sell me to Voldemort."
More silence followed his words. They were all looking at him. Harry felt a little hot again and drank some more fire whiskey for something to do. As he drank, he thought of Mad-Eye. Mad-Eye had always been scathing about Dumbledore's willingness to trust people.
"Well said, Harry,"
said Fred unexpectedly.
"Yeah, ear, ear,"
said George, with a half-glance at Fred, the corner of whose mouth twitched. Lupin was wearing an odd expression as he looked at Harry. It was close to pitying.
"You think I'm a fool?" demanded Harry.
"No,
I think you're like James," said Lupin, "who would have regarded it as the height of dishonor to mistrust his friends."
Harry knew what Lupin was getting at, that his father had been betrayed by his friend Peter Pettigrew. He felt irrationally angry. He wanted to argue, but Lupin had turned away from him, set down his glass upon a side table, and addressed Bill.
"There's work to do. I can ask Kingsley whether..."
"No," said Bill at once. "I'll do it. I'll come." "Where are you going?"
said Tonks and Fleur together.
"Mad-Eye's body," said Lupin. "We need to recover it."
"Can't it?"
began Mrs. Weasley, with an appealing look at Bill.
"Wait," said Bill.
Not unless you'd rather the Death Eaters took it. Nobody spoke. Lupin and Bill said goodbye and left. The rest of them now dropped into chairs, all except for Harry, who remained standing. The suddenness and completeness of death was with them like a presence. "I've got to go too," said Harry. 10 pairs of startled eyes looked at him.
"Don't be silly, Harry," said Mrs. Weasley. "What are you talking about? I can't stay here."
He rubbed his forehead. It was prickling again. It had not hurt like this for more than a year. "You're all in danger while I'm here. I don't want..."
"But don't be so silly," said Mrs. Weasley. "The whole point of tonight was to get you here safely, and thank goodness it worked. And Fleur's agreed to get married here rather than in France. We've arranged everything so that we can all stay together and look after you."
She did not understand. She was making him feel worse, not better. "If Voldemort finds out I'm here..."
"But why should he?"
asked Mrs. Weasley.
"There are a dozen places you might be now, Harry," said Mr. Weasley. "He's got no way of knowing which safe house you're in."
"It's not me I'm worried for," said Harry.
"We know that," said Mr. Weasley quietly. "But it would make our efforts tonight seem rather pointless if you left."
"You're not going anywhere," growled Hagrid. "Blimey, Harry, after all we went through to get you here."
"Yeah, what about my bleeding ear?" said George, hoisting himself up on his cushions.
"I know that. Mad-Eye wouldn't want..."
"I know," Harry bellowed. He felt beleaguered and blackmailed. Did they think he did not know what they had done for him? Didn't they understand that it was for precisely that reason that he wanted to go now, before they had to suffer any more on his behalf? There was a long and awkward silence in which his scar continued to prickle and throb, and which was broken at last by Mrs. Weasley.
"Where's Hedwig, Harry?"
she said coaxingly.
"We can put her up with Pigwidgeon and give her something to eat."
His insides clenched like a fist. He could not tell her the truth. He drank the last of his fire whiskey to avoid answering.
"Wait till it gets out you did it again, Harry," said Hagrid. "Escaped him. Fought him off when he was right on top of you."
"It wasn't me," said Harry flatly. "It was my wand. My wand acted of its own accord." After a few moments, Hermione said gently,
"But that's impossible, Harry. You mean that you did magic without meaning to. You reacted instinctively."
"No," said Harry. "The bike was falling.
I couldn't have told you where Voldemort was, but my wand spun in my hand and found him and shot a spell at him, and it wasn't even the spell I recognized. I've never made gold flames appear before."
"Often," said Mr. Weasley, "when you're in a pressured situation, you can produce magic you never dreamed of. Small children often find before they're trained."
"It wasn't like that," said Harry through gritted teeth. His scar was burning. He felt angry and frustrated. He hated the idea that they were all imagining him to have power to match Voldemort's. No one said anything. He knew that they did not believe him. Now that he came to think of it, he had never heard of a wand performing magic on its own before. His scar seared with pain. It was all he could do not to moan aloud. Muttering about fresh air, he set down his glass and left the room. As he crossed the dark yard, the great skeletal thestral looked up, rustled its enormous bat-like wings, then resumed its grazing. Harry stopped at the gate into the garden, staring out at its overgrown plants, rubbing his pounding forehead, and thinking of Dumbledore. Dumbledore would have believed him, he knew it. Dumbledore would have known how and why Harry's wand had acted independently, because Dumbledore always had the answers. He had known about wands, had explained to Harry the strange connection that existed between his wand and Voldemort's. But Dumbledore, like Mad-Eye, like Sirius, like his parents, like his poor owl, all were gone, where Harry could never talk to them again. He felt a burning in his throat that had nothing to do with fire whiskey. And then, out of nowhere, the pain in his scar peaked. As he clutched his forehead and closed his eyes, a voice screamed inside his head.
You told me the problem would be solved by using another's wand.
And into his mind burst the vision of an emaciated old man lying in rags upon a stone floor, screaming, a horrible drawn-out scream, a scream of unendurable agony.
No, no, I beg you, I beg you. You lied to Lord Voldemort, Ollivander. I did not. I swear I did not. You sought to help Potter, to help him escape me. I swear I did not. I believed a different wand could work. Explaining what happened. Lucius's wand is destroyed. I cannot understand. The connection exists only between your two wands. Lies, please! I beg you!
And Harry saw the white hand raise its wand and felt Voldemort's surge of vicious anger, saw the frail old man on the floor writhe in agony.
Harry!
It was over as quickly as it had come. Harry stood shaking in the darkness, clutching the gate into the garden, his heart racing, his scar still tingling. It was several moments before he realized that Ron and Hermione were at his side.
"Harry, come back in the house," Hermione whispered. "You aren't still thinking of leaving?"
"Yeah, you got to stay, mate," said Ron, thumping Harry on the back.
"Are you all right?"
Hermione asked, close enough now to look into Harry's face.
"You look awful."
"Well," said Harry shakily, "I probably look better than Ollivander."
When he had finished telling them what he had seen, Ron looked appalled, but Hermione downright terrified.
"But it was supposed to have stopped. Your scar. It wasn't supposed to do this anymore. You mustn't let that connection open up again. Dumbledore wanted you to close your mind."
When he did not reply, she gripped his arm.
"Harry, he's taking over the ministry, and the newspapers, and half the wizarding world. Don't let him inside your head, too."
Chapter 6. The Ghoul in Pajamas. The shock of losing Mad-Eye hung over the house in the days that followed. Harry kept expecting to see him stumping in through the back door like the other Order members, who passed in and out to relay news. Harry felt that nothing but action would assuage his feelings of guilt and grief, and that he ought to set out on his mission to find and destroy Horcruxes as soon as possible.
"Well, you can't do anything about the—"
Ron mouthed the word, "Horcruxes,
till you're 17. You've still got the trace on you. And we can plan here as well as anywhere, can't we? Or—"
he dropped his voice to a whisper.
"Do you reckon you already know where the you-know-whats are?"
"No," Harry admitted. "I think Hermione's been doing a bit of research," said Ron. "She said she was saving it for when you got here."
They were sitting at the breakfast table. Mr. Weasley and Bill had just left for work. Mrs. Weasley had gone upstairs to wake Hermione and Ginny, while Fleur had drifted off to take a bath.
"The trace'll break on the 31st, said Harry. "That means I only need to stay here 4 days. Then I can—"
5 days,
Ron corrected him firmly.
"We've got to stay for the wedding. They'll kill us if we miss it."
Harry understood "they" to mean Fleur and Mrs. Weasley.
"It's one extra day," said Ron, when Harry looked mutinous. "Don't they realize how important—"
"Course they don't," said Ron. "They haven't got a clue. And now you mention it, I wanted to talk to you about that."
Ron glanced toward the door into the hall to check that Mrs. Weasley was not returning yet, then leaned in closer to Harry.
"Mum's been trying to get it out of Hermione and me, what we're off to do. She'll try you next, so brace yourself. Dad and Lupin have both asked as well, but when we said Dumbledore told you not to tell anyone except us, they dropped it. Not Mum, though. She's determined."
Ron's prediction came true within hours. Shortly before lunch, Mrs. Weasley detached Harry from the others by asking him to help identify a lone man's sock that she thought might have come out of his rucksack. Once she had him cornered in the tiny scullery off the kitchen, she started.
"Ron and Hermione seem to think
that the three of you are dropping out of Hogwarts," she began in a light, casual tone.
"Oh," said Harry. "Well, yeah, we are."
The mangle turned of its own accord in a corner, wringing out what looked like one of Mr. Weasley's vests.
"May I ask why you are abandoning your education?" said Mrs. Weasley.
"Well, Dumbledore left me stuff to do," mumbled Harry. "Ron and Hermione know about it, and they want to come, too."
"What sort of stuff?"
"I'm sorry, I can't..."
"Well, frankly, I think Arthur and I have a right to know, and I'm sure Mr. and Mrs. Granger would agree," said Mrs. Weasley.
Harry had been afraid of the concerned parent attack. He forced himself to look directly into her eyes, noticing as he did so that they were precisely the same shade of brown as Ginny's. This did not help. "Dumbledore didn't want anyone else to know, Mrs. Weasley.
I'm sorry. Ron and Hermione don't have to come. It's their choice."
"I don't see that you have to go either," she snapped, dropping all pretense now. "You're barely of age, any of you. It's utter nonsense. If Dumbledore needed work doing, he had the whole order at his command. Harry, you must have misunderstood him. Probably he was telling you something he wanted done, and you took it to mean that he wanted you."
"I didn't misunderstand," said Harry flatly. "It's got to be me."
He handed her back the single sock he was supposed to be identifying, which was patterned with golden bulrushes.
"And that's not mine. I don't support Puddlemere United."
"Oh, of course not,"
said Mrs. Weasley, with a sudden and rather unnerving return to her casual tone.
"I should have realized. Well, Harry, while we've still got you here, you won't mind helping with the preparations for Bill and Fleur's wedding, will you? There's still so much to do."
"No, I..." "Of course not," said Harry, disconcerted by this sudden change of subject.
"Sweet of you,"
she replied, and she smiled as she left the scullery. From that moment on, Mrs. Weasley kept Harry, Ron, and Hermione so busy with preparations for the wedding that they hardly had any time to think. The kindest explanation of this behavior would have been that Mrs. Weasley wanted to distract them all from thoughts of Mad-Eye and the terrors of their recent journey. After 2 days of non-stop cutlery cleaning, of color-matching favors, ribbons, and flowers, of denoming the garden and helping Mrs. Weasley cook vast batches of canapés, however, Harry started to suspect her of a different motive. All the jobs she handed out seemed to keep him, Ron, and Hermione away from one another. He had not had a chance to speak to the two of them alone since the first night, when he had told them about Voldemort torturing Ollivander.
"I think Mum thinks that if she can stop the three of you getting together and planning, she'll be able to delay you leaving,"
Ginny told Harry in an undertone as they laid the table for dinner on the third night of his stay.
"And then what does she think's going to happen?" Harry muttered.
"Someone else might kill off Voldemort while she's holding us here making vol-au-vent."
He had spoken without thinking, and saw Ginny's face whiten.
"So it's true," she said. "That's what you're trying to do." I was joking," said Harry evasively.
They stared at each other, and there was something more than shock in Ginny's expression. Suddenly, Harry became aware that this was the first time that he had been alone with her since those stolen hours in secluded corners of the Hogwarts grounds. He was sure she was remembering them, too. Both of them jumped as the door opened, and Mr. Weasley, Kingsley, and Bill walked in. They were often joined by other Order members for dinner now, because the Burrow had replaced Number 12 Grimmauld Place as the headquarters. Mr. Weasley had explained that after the death of Dumbledore, their secret keeper, each of the people to whom Dumbledore had confided Grimmauld Place's location had become a secret keeper in turn.
"And as there are around 20 of us, that greatly dilutes the power of the Fidelius charm. 20 times as many opportunities for the Death Eaters to get the secret out of somebody. We can't expect it to hold much longer."
"But surely Snape will have told the Death Eaters the address by now?" asked Harry.
"Well, Mad-Eye set up a couple of curses against Snape in case he turns up there again. We hope they'll be strong enough both to keep him out and to bind his tongue if he tries to talk about the place, but We can't be sure. It would have been insane to keep using the place's headquarters now that its protection has become so shaky.
The kitchen was so crowded that evening, it was difficult to maneuver knives and forks. Harry found himself crammed beside Ginny. The unsaid things that had just passed between them made him wish they had been separated by a few more people. He was trying so hard to avoid brushing her arm, he could barely cut his chicken.
"No news about Mad-Eye?" Harry asked Bill.
"Nothing,"
replied Bill. They had not been able to hold a funeral for Moody, because Bill and Lupin had failed to recover his body. It had been difficult to know where he might have fallen, given the darkness and the confusion of the battle.
"The Daily Prophet hasn't said a word about him dying or about finding the body," Bill went on. "But that doesn't mean much. It's keeping a lot quiet these days."
"And they still haven't called a hearing about all the underage magic I used escaping the Death Eaters?" Harry called across the table to Mr. Weasley, who shook his head.
"Because they know I had no choice, or because they don't want me to tell the world Voldemort attacked me?"
"The latter, I think. Scrimgeour doesn't want to admit that you-know-who is as powerful as he is, nor that Azkaban's seen a mass breakout."
"Yeah, why tell the public the truth?" said Harry, clenching his knife so tightly that the faint scars on the back of his right hand stood out, white against his skin.
"I must not tell lies." "Isn't anyone at the Ministry prepared to stand up to him?" asked Ron angrily.
"Of course, Ron, but people are terrified," Mr. Weasley replied. "Terrified that they will be next to disappear, their children the next to be attacked. There are nasty rumours going around. I, for one, don't believe the Muggle Studies professor at Hogwarts resigned. She hasn't been seen for weeks now. Meanwhile, Scrimgeour remains shut up in his office all day. I just hope he's working on a plan."
There was a pause in which Mrs. Weasley magicked the empty plates onto the work surface and served apple tart.
"We must decide how you will be disguised, Harry," said Fleur once everyone had pudding. "For the wedding," she added when he looked confused. "Of course, none of our guests are Death Eaters, but we cannot guarantee that they will not let something slip after they have had champagne."
From this, Harry gathered that she still suspected Hagrid.
"Yes, good point,"
said Mrs. Weasley from the top of the table where she sat, spectacles perched on the end of her nose, scanning an immense list of jobs that she had scribbled on a very long piece of parchment.
"Now, Ron, have you cleaned out your room yet?"
"Why?"
exclaimed Ron, slamming his spoon down and glaring at his mother.
"Why does my room have to be cleaned out? Harry and I are fine with it the way it is."
"We are holding your brother's wedding here in a few days' time, young man."
"And are they getting married in my bedroom?" asked Ron furiously. "No. So, why in the name of Merlin's saggy left—"
"Don't talk to your mother like that," said Mr. Weasley firmly, "and do as you're told."
Ron scowled at both his parents, then picked up his spoon and attacked the last few mouthfuls of his apple tart.
"I can help. Some of it's my mess," Harry told Ron, but Mrs. Weasley cut across him.
"No, Harry dear, I'd much rather you helped Arthur muck out the chickens, and Hermione, I'd be ever so grateful if you'd change the sheets for Monsieur and Madame Delacour. You know they're arriving at 11 tomorrow morning."
But as it turned out, there was very little to do for the chickens.
"There's no need to mention it to Molly,"
Mr. Weasley told Harry, blocking his access to the coop.
"But, Ted Tonks sent me most of what was left of Sirius's bike, and, I'm hiding, that's to say, keeping it in here. Fantastic stuff. There's an exhaust gaskin, as I believe it's called, the most magnificent battery, and it'll be a great opportunity to find out how brakes work. I'm going to try and put it all back together again when Molly's not, I mean, when I've got time."
When they returned to the house, Mrs. Weasley was nowhere to be seen, so Harry slipped upstairs to Ron's attic bedroom.
"I'm doing it! I'm doing—"
"Oh, it's you," said Ron in relief as Harry entered the room. Ron lay back down on the bed, which he had evidently just vacated. The room was just as messy as it had been all week. The only change was that Hermione was now sitting in the far corner, her fluffy ginger cat Crookshanks at her feet, sorting books, some of which Harry recognized as his own, into two enormous piles. "Hi, Harry," she said, as he sat down on his camp bed. "And how did you manage to get away?"
"Oh, Ron's mum forgot that she asked Ginny and me to change the sheets yesterday," said Hermione.
She threw numerology and grammatica onto one pile and the rise and fall of the dark arts onto the other.
"We were just talking about Mad-Eye," Ron told Harry. "I reckon he might have survived."
"But Bill saw him hit by the killing curse," said Harry.
"Yeah, but Bill was under attack too," said Ron. "How can he be sure what he saw? Even if the killing curse missed, Mad-Eye still fell about 1,000 feet, said Hermione, now weighing Quidditch teams of Britain and Ireland in her hand. "He could have used a shield charm."
"Fleur said his wand was blasted out of his hand," said Harry.
"Well, all right, if you want him to be dead,"
said Ron grumpily, punching his pillow into a more comfortable shape.
"Of course we don't want him to be dead," said Hermione, looking shocked. "It's dreadful that he's dead, but we're being realistic."
For the first time, Harry imagined Mad-Eye's body, broken as Dumbledore's had been, yet with that one eye still whizzing in its socket. He felt a stab of revulsion mixed with a bizarre desire to laugh.
"The Death Eaters probably tied it up after themselves. That's why no one's found him," said Ron wisely.
"Yeah," said Harry. "Like Barty Crouch, turned into a bone and buried in Hagrid's front garden. They probably transfigured Moody and stuffed him..."
"Don't!"
squealed Hermione. Startled, Harry looked over just in time to see her burst into tears over her copy of Spellman's Syllabary.
"Oh, no," said Harry, struggling to get up from the old camp bed. "Hermione, I wasn't trying to upset..."
But with a great creaking of rusty bedsprings, Ron bounded off the bed and got there first. One arm around Hermione, he fished in his jeans pocket and withdrew a revolting-looking handkerchief that he had used to clean out the oven earlier. Hastily pulling out his wand, he pointed it at the rag and said,
"Tergio!"
The wand siphoned off most of the grease. Looking rather pleased with himself, Ron handed the slightly smoking handkerchief to Hermione.
"Oh, thanks, Ron. I'm sorry."
She blew her nose and hiccuped.
"It's just so awful, isn't it? Right after Dumbledore. I just never imagined Mad-Eye dying. Somehow he seems so tough."
"Yeah, I know," said Ron, giving her a squeeze.
"But you know what he'd say to us if he was here?" "Constant vigilance," said Hermione, mopping her eyes. "That's right," said Ron, nodding.
"He'd tell us to learn from what happened to him, and what I've learned is not to trust that cowardly little squit, Mundungus."
Hermione gave a shaky laugh and leaned forward to pick up two more books. A second later, Ron had snatched his arm back from around her shoulders. She had dropped the Monster Book of Monsters on his foot. The book had broken free from its restraining belt and snapped viciously at Ron's ankle.
I'm sorry,"
Hermione cried as Harry wrenched the book from Ron's leg and retied it shut.
"What are you doing with all those books anyway?"
Ron asked, limping back to his bed.
"Just trying to decide which ones to take with us,"
said Hermione,
"when we're looking for the Horcruxes."
"Oh, of course," said Ron, clapping a hand to his forehead. "I forgot we'll be hunting down Voldemort in a mobile library."
"Ha ha,"
said Hermione, looking down at Spellman's Syllabary.
"I wonder, will we need to translate runes? It's possible. I think we'd better take it, to be safe."
She dropped the syllabary onto the larger of the two piles and picked up Hogwarts, a history.
"Listen," said Harry.
He had sat up straight. Ron and Hermione looked at him with similar mixtures of resignation and defiance.
"I know you said after Dumbledore's funeral that you wanted to come with me,"
Harry began.
"Here he goes," Ron said to Hermione, rolling his eyes.
"As we knew he would," she sighed, turning back to the books. "You know, I think I will take Hogwarts a history.
Even if we're not going back there, I don't think I'd feel right if I didn't have it with...
Listen, said Harry again.
No, Harry, you listen, said Hermione. We're coming with you. That was decided months ago. Years, really.
But shut up, Ron advised him. Are you sure you've thought this through? Harry persisted.
Let's see,
said Hermione, slamming Travels with Trolls onto the discarded pile with a rather fierce look.
I've been packing for days, so we're ready to leave at a moment's notice, which, for your information, has included doing some pretty difficult magic, not to mention smuggling Mad-Eye's whole stock of Polyjuice Potion right under Ron's mum's nose. I've also modified my parents' memories so that they're convinced they're really called Wendell and Monica Wilkins, and that their life's ambition is to move to Australia, which they have now done. That's to make it more difficult for Voldemort to track them down and interrogate them about me, or you, because unfortunately I've told them quite a bit about you. Assuming I survive our hunt for the Horcruxes, I'll find Mum and Dad and lift the enchantment. If I don't, well, I think I've cast a good enough charm to keep them safe and happy. Wendell and Monica Wilkins don't know that they've got a daughter, you see.
Hermione's eyes were swimming with tears again. Ron got back off the bed, put his arm around her once more, and frowned at Harry, as though reproaching him for lack of tact. Harry could not think of anything to say, not least because it was highly unusual for Ron to be teaching anyone else tact.
Hermione, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that Ron and I know perfectly well what might happen if we come with you. Well, we do. Ron... Show Harry what you've done.
Nah, he's just eaten, said Ron.
Go on, he needs to know.
Oh, all right.
Harry, come here.
For the second time, Ron withdrew his arm from around Hermione and stumped over to the door.
Come on.
Why? Harry asked, following Ron out of the room onto the tiny landing.
Descendo,
muttered Ron, pointing his wand at the low ceiling. A hatch opened right over their heads, and a ladder slid down to their feet. A horrible, half-sucking, half-moaning sound came out of the square hole, along with an unpleasant smell like open drains.
"That's your ghoul, isn't it?"
asked Harry, who had never actually met the creature that sometimes disrupted the nightly silence.
"Yeah, it is,"
said Ron, climbing the ladder.
"Come and have a look at him."
Harry followed Ron up the few short steps into the tiny attic space. His head and shoulders were in the room before he caught sight of the creature curled up a few feet from him, fast asleep in the gloom with its large mouth wide open.
But it looks... Do ghouls normally wear pajamas?
No, said Ron, nor have they usually got red hair or that number of pustules. Harry contemplated the thing, slightly revolted. It was human in shape and size and was wearing what, now that Harry's eyes became used to the darkness, was clearly an old pair of Ron's pajamas. He was also sure that ghouls were generally rather slimy and bald, rather than distinctly hairy and covered in angry purple blisters.
"He's me, see?"
said Ron.
"No," said Harry, "I don't. I'll explain it back in my room. The smell's getting to me," said Ron.
They climbed back down the ladder, which Ron returned to the ceiling, and rejoined Hermione, who was still sorting books.
"Once we've left, the ghoul's going to come and live down here in my room," said Ron. "I think he's really looking forward to it. Well, it's hard to tell, because all he can do is moan and drool, but he nods a lot when you mention it. Anyway, he's going to be me with Spattergroit."
"Good, eh?"
Harry merely looked his confusion.
"It is," said Ron, clearly frustrated that Harry had not grasped the brilliance of the plan.
"Look, when we three don't turn up at Hogwarts again, everyone's going to think Hermione and I must be with you, right? Which means the Death Eaters will go straight for our families to see if they've got information on where you are. But hopefully it'll look like I've gone away with Mum and Dad. A lot of Muggleborns are talking about going into hiding at the moment," said Hermione. "We can't hide my whole family. It'll look too fishy, and they can't all leave their jobs," said Ron. "So we're going to put out the story that I'm seriously ill with Spattergroit, which is why I can't go back to school.
If anyone comes calling to investigate, Mum or Dad can show them the ghoul in my bed, covered in pustules. Spattergroit's really contagious, so they're not going to want to go near him. It won't matter that he can't say anything either, because apparently you can't once the fungus has spread to your uvula.
And your Mum and Dad are in on this plan? Asked Harry.
Daddy's? He helped Fred and George transform the ghoul. Mum, well, you've seen what she's like. She won't accept we're going till we've gone.
There was silence in the room, broken only by gentle thuds as Hermione continued to throw books onto one pile or the other. Ron sat watching her, and Harry looked from one to the other, unable to say anything. The measures they had taken to protect their families made him realize, more than anything else could have done, that they really were going to come with him, and that they knew exactly how dangerous that would be. He wanted to tell them what that meant to him, but he simply could not find words important enough. Through the silence came the muffled sounds of Mrs. Weasley shouting from four floors below.
"Ginny's probably left a speck of dust on a poxy napkin ring," said Ron. "I don't know why the Delacours have got to come 2 days before the wedding. Fleur's sister's a bridesmaid. She needs to be here for the rehearsal, and she's too young to come on her own," said Hermione, as she pored indecisively over Break with a Banshee.
"Well, guests aren't going to help Mum's stress levels," said Ron.
"What we really need to decide," said Hermione, tossing Defensive Magical Theory into the bin without a second glance and picking up An Appraisal of Magical Education in Europe, "is where we're going after we leave here. I know you said you wanted to go to Godric's Hollow first, Harry, and I understand why, but, well, shouldn't we make the Horcruxes our priority?"
"If we knew where any of the Horcruxes were, I'd agree with you," said Harry, who did not believe that Hermione really understood his desire to return to Godric's Hollow. His parents' graves were only part of the attraction. He had a strong, though inexplicable, feeling that the place held answers for him. Perhaps it was simply because it was there that he had survived Voldemort's killing curse. Now that he was facing the challenge of repeating the feat, Harry was drawn to the place where it had happened, wanting to understand.
"Don't you think there's a possibility that Voldemort's keeping a watch on Godric's Hollow?" Hermione asked. "He might expect you to go back and visit your parents' graves once you're free to go wherever you like."
This had not occurred to Harry. While he struggled to find a counter-argument, Ron spoke up, evidently following his own train of thought.
"This R.A.B. person," he said, "you know, the one who stole the real locket." Hermione nodded. "He said in his note he was going to destroy it, didn't he?"
Harry dragged his rucksack toward him and pulled out the fake Horcrux, in which R.A.B.'s note was still folded. "I have stolen the real Horcrux and intend to destroy it as soon as I can," Harry read out.
"Well, what if he did finish it off?" said Ron.
"Or she,"
interposed Hermione.
"Whichever," said Ron. "It'd be one less for us to do."
"Yes, but we're still going to have to try and trace the real locket, aren't we?"
said Hermione,
"to find out whether or not it's destroyed."
"And once we get hold of it,
how do you destroy a Horcrux?" asked Ron.
"Well," said Hermione,
"I've been researching that."
"How?" asked Harry.
"I didn't think there were any books on Horcruxes in the library."
"There weren't,"
said Hermione, who had turned pink.
"Dumbledore removed them all, but he didn't destroy them."
Ron sat up straight, wide-eyed.
"How in the name of Merlin's pants have you managed to get your hands on those Horcrux books?"
It wasn't sealing,"
said Hermione, looking from Harry to Ron with a kind of desperation.
"They were still library books, even if Dumbledore had taken them off the shelves. Anyway, if he really didn't want anyone to get at them, I'm sure he would have made it much harder to..."
"Get to the point," said Ron.
"Well, it was easy,"
said Hermione in a small voice.
"I just did a summoning charm, you know, Accio, and they zoomed out of Dumbledore's study window right into the girls' dormitory."
"But when did you do this?" Harry asked, regarding Hermione with a mixture of admiration and incredulity.
"Just after his Dumbledore's funeral,"
said Hermione in an even smaller voice.
"Right after we agreed we'd leave school and go and look for the Horcruxes. When I went back upstairs to get my things, it just occurred to me that the more we knew about them, the better it would be. And I was alone in there, so I tried. And it worked. They flew straight in through the open window, and I packed them.
She swallowed, and then said imploringly,
I can't believe Dumbledore would have been angry. It's not as though we're going to use the information to make a Horcrux, is it?
Can you hear us complaining? Said Ron.
Where are these books, anyway?
Hermione rummaged for a moment, and then extracted from the pile a large volume bound in faded black leather. She looked a little nauseated and held it as gingerly as if it was something recently dead.
This is the one that gives explicit instructions on how to make a Horcrux. Secrets of the Darkest Art. It's a horrible book, really awful, full of evil magic. I wonder when Dumbledore removed it from the library. If he didn't do it until he was headmaster, I bet Voldemort got all the instructions he needed from here. Why did he have to ask Slughorn how to make a Horcrux then, if he'd already read that? Asked Ron.
He only approached Slughorn to find out what would happen if you split your soul into seven, said Harry. Dumbledore was sure Riddle already knew how to make a Horcrux by the time he asked Slughorn about them.
I think you're right, Hermione. That could easily have been where he got the information. And the more I've read about them, said Hermione, the more horrible they seem, and the less I can believe that he actually made six. It warns in this book how unstable you make the rest of your soul by ripping it, and that's just by making one Horcrux.
Harry remembered what Dumbledore had said about Voldemort moving beyond usual evil.
"Isn't there any way of putting yourself back together?"
Ron asked.
"Yes," said Hermione with a hollow smile. "But it will be excruciatingly painful."
"Why? How do you do it?"
asked Harry. "Remorse," said Hermione. "You've got to really feel what you've done. There's a footnote. Apparently the pain of it can destroy you. I can't see Voldemort attempting it somehow, can you?"
"No," said Ron before Harry could answer. "So, does it say how to destroy Horcruxes in that book?"
Yes, said Hermione, now turning the fragile pages as if examining rotting entrails. Because it warns dark wizards how strong they have to make the enchantments on them. From all that I've read, what Harry did to Riddle's diary was one of the few really foolproof ways of destroying a Horcrux.
What, stabbing it with a basilisk fang? Asked Harry.
Ah, well, lucky we've got such a large supply of basilisk fangs then, said Ron. I was wondering what we were going to do with them.
It doesn't have to be a basilisk fang, said Hermione patiently. It has to be something so destructive that the Horcrux can't repair itself. Basilisk venom only has one antidote, and it's incredibly rare.
Phoenix tears, said Harry, nodding.
Exactly, said Hermione. Our problem is that there are very few substances as destructive as basilisk venom, and they're all dangerous to carry around with you. That's a problem we're going to have to solve, though, because ripping, smashing, or crushing a Horcrux won't do the trick. You've got to put it beyond magical repair.
But even if we wreck the thing it lives in, said Ron, why can't the bit of soul in it just go and live in something else?
Because a Horcrux is the complete opposite of a human being.
Seeing that Harry and Ron looked thoroughly confused, Hermione hurried on.
Look, if I picked up a sword right now, Ron, and ran you through with it, I wouldn't damage your soul at all.
Which would be a real comfort to me, I'm sure, said Ron.
Harry laughed.
It should be, actually, but my point is that whatever happens to your body, your soul will survive, untouched, said Hermione. But it's the other way round with a Horcrux. The fragment of soul inside it depends on its container, its enchanted body, for survival. It can't exist without it.
That diary sort of died when I stabbed it, said Harry, remembering ink pouring like blood from the punctured pages, and the screams of the piece of Voldemort's soul as it vanished.
And once the diary was properly destroyed, the bit of soul trapped in it could no longer exist. Ginny tried to get rid of the diary before you did, flushing it away, but obviously it came back good as new.
Hang on, said Ron, frowning. The bit of soul in that diary was possessing Ginny, wasn't it? How does that work, then?
While the magical container is still intact,
The bit of soul inside it can flit in and out of someone if they get too close to the object. I don't mean holding it for too long. It's nothing to do with touching it, she added before Ron could speak. I mean close emotionally. Ginny poured her heart out into that diary. She made herself incredibly vulnerable. You're in trouble if you get too fond of or dependent on the Horcrux.